Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight we hear a lecture by Professor Dr. Kurt Biedenkopf, former Minister President of Saxony, entitled The Future of American-European Relations. Recorded last month at the School of Law's Barrister Hall, this lecture was presented by the Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University in cooperation with the American Council on Germany and the Goethe Institute, Boston. Responding to Professor Biedenkopf's remarks is Peter Hall, Krupp Foundation Professor of European Studies at Harvard University. We begin with an introduction of our speakers by Boston University Chancellor John Silber.
As Chancellor of Boston University, it's my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Kurt Biedenkopf, former Minister President of Saxony and one of Germany's most accomplished statesmen. Dr. Biedenkopf is going to speak to us today about the future of American-European relations. I cannot think of a more relevant or more pressing issue than this one. In light of recent events, we might be tempted to ask Dr. Biedenkopf to clarify his paper's title. Which Europe does he plan to discuss? The Europe that inspired Jacques Chirac, Vladimir Putin, and Gerhard Schroeder to meet in St. Petersburg, or the Europe of Tony Blair, Vaclav Havel, José Aznar, and dozens of other leaders who backed the American-led war with Iraq? Are we to consider American relations with the old Europe or with the new? Or can Europe be so easily divided? What shall we expect? As an erudite scholar of economics, law, and international relations, and a master of electoral politics as well, Dr. Biedenkopf has made a career of defying expectations. Educated in law in Germany and the United States, Dr. Biedenkopf first made his name as a Christian Democrat determined to reform the Federal Republic's Sozialmarktwirtschaft. Dr. Biedenkopf's willingness to warn of demographic changes that would strain Germany's welfare state earned him the admiration of peers, except, that is, one Rhineland traditionalist by the name of Helmut Kohl. German reunification finally gave Dr. Biedenkopf the chance to show that his classical liberal ideals could work in a society as illiberal as the former communist East. After a few months of teaching economics at the University of Leipzig, Dr. Biedenkopf led the Christian Democrats to the first of many victories in the state of Saxony and then served as Saxony's minister president for the next 12 years. At a time when most Vessies were promising instant wealth to the Aussies, Dr. Biedenkopf instead warned of the bleak decade to come. His straight talk won him a mandate to reform Saxony's educational system, to sell off its state-owned companies, and to hire and lure investment. Crowned king of Saxony by The Economist, Dr. Biedenkopf created what is arguably one of the most dynamic regions in Europe, East or West, old or young. After Dr. Biedenkopf's talk, we will hear a response from Peter Hall, Krupp Professor of European Studies at Harvard and Director of the University's Mende de Gunsberg Center for European Studies. Professor Hall is the author of dozens of articles on European social and economic policy and of The Governing the Economy, the Politics of State Intervention in Britain and France, published in 1986. I'm pleased that he could join us as well. And the floor is yours now.
Thank you, sir, for the introduction and for giving my talk a certain direction right at the beginning, and I'll gladly pick that up. When I went to Davidson College in 1949-50, for the first year in the United States, only 4 years after the Second World War, I was asked to write a weekly column in the Davidsonian, which is the college paper. And the last column I wrote before I departed, heavy-hearted, I must say, from Davidson back to Germany, I spoke in that little column about the old and the new world. You can also say the old Europe and the new America. I expressed the hope that both would learn from one another. Europe from the vitality of the United States and the United States from the wisdom of Europe. I would be willing to write that again. I think that the dialogue that is happily being picked up again by Mr. Chirac, and since he was the main villain in the weeks past or the months past, I think the restoration of that dialogue is a very good omen to continued cooperation in a very difficult period, both for the United States and for Europe. I will try to make a few statements on some basic points of the relationship, both between the United States and Germany and the United States and Europe, and then enlarge within the time frame that we have agreed to use for the introductory remarks on some of the future problems and challenges that we face. It's always been my belief in foreign policy, and especially in Atlantic community policy, that the best way to approach our community of interests is by testing it at the hand of the problems we have to solve together. But let me come to the questions you asked about the new and the old Europe. Europe as a whole, in its present configuration, is old compared to the age of the United States. It has, as Germany has, all of Europe have, with different emphases, contributed greatly to the period of incipiency of what later became the United States of America through immigration. And Germany contributed, as did Italy and Spain and others, a very significant part of that immigration. There is also a very considerable community in the cultural area. NATO was built not only on the desire to defend Europe and the United States against communism in general, and the Soviet Union in particular, even though that developed to be the dominant purpose of the Atlantic Alliance, but it was also directed at economic cooperation and at the development of our common values. Americans that I talked to during the period of dissent, let me call it that, and irritation, often asked why the Europeans weren't more grateful. That was especially directed at France and Germany. Now, basically speaking, gratitude is not a political category. And it certainly is not a political category that determines the relationship of states or nations. But it is part of our culture to remind us, and I'm very gladly doing this, that Europe would not look the way it looks today if it weren't for the United States. And that is true both for the development of the European Union, or what began as the European Economic Community, as it is true for the reunification of Germany and Europe. Both processes were not possible, would have not been possible, if the United States had not guaranteed the freedom and the security of what we have come to call the free Europe, namely that part of Europe that was not occupied by the Soviet Union. This is true both during the period of an aggressive stance of the Soviet Union, as well as during the whole period of building the European Union. Germany's reunification would not have been possible without the United States, and nobody in Germany doubts that. It was the then President George Bush who assured the Soviet Union that a reunification of Germany would not alter what the Soviet Union felt was an indispensable continuation of the status quo, with other words, a structural status quo within Europe. the United States guaranteed that Germany, the United Germany, would not disturb the power balance within Europe and thus allowed the Soviet Union to accept not only German unification or reunification, but also the increasing participation of former satellite countries in the European process. When the Soviet Union broke down shortly after European unification, it became clear that the old order was drawing to an end. I think, John, if we want to follow that up, we have to keep in mind that two dates changed the world in the last 12 or 13 years. The first one I've already related to, November 9, 1989, when the wall came down, the Cold War ended, and the Soviet Union disappeared short after. And, of course, 9/11, the terrorist attack on America. I think that the attack on the Twin Towers ended a period of undisputed protection and invulnerability of the United States as a nation. It was not thought possible that any attack would be directed against the United States' home territory, that home security would be in jeopardy. And the reaction of the United States population as well as government of the United States at large to this event was a reaction that went in its depth all the way to the roots of the identity of this nation. The other factor that dates back formally to November 9th is that with the disappearance of the Soviet Union, a power vacuum was created. And that power vacuum is not filled and has not been filled. And the first thing we can say about European-American relations is that it is certainly not going to be filled by Europe. So we have today a situation where America is the sole world power, or sometimes even referred to as hyperpower. Anyway, it's the most impressive military power. It's the most impressive economic power. And it has very strong cultural assets to its development and its strength. It is a representation of Western culture, Western values, and Western beliefs. It has been that, and it will continue to be that. The relationship between Europe and the United States will be determined by how this structural situation, a world power, a seemingly disunited Europe on matters of foreign policy and security policy, and the evolution of possibly future powers like China and India will shape the world order in the future. Old President Bush in the early 90s already proclaimed that a new world order had come into existence, and he offered Germany a partnership in leadership. Germany could not and would not accept this offer for herself, but for Europe. And at that time, there seemed all signs were pointing to a development where such a partnership between Europe and the United States would develop, minus the confrontation with the Soviet Union. But it proved during the period until 9/11 and then the beginning discussions on the military action in Iraq or the war against Iraq, that a new world order has not yet come into existence. So the eminent purpose of the continuation of the Atlantic Alliance and the Atlantic Community will be the structuring of such an order. We have learned from the experience within the last month that one thing is not possible, And that led also to the differentiation between the old and the new Europe. It is not possible to unite Europe against the United States. If that would have ever been the purpose of Chirac's particular position within the Security Council and towards the United States, and possibly also the intention of Chancellor Schroeder and Mr. Putin, it would fail. By the way, I don't think that Russia ever thought it was possible to unite Europe against the United States. What Russia did was seize on the occasion of a dispute between two of the leading countries in Europe, as it seems, led by France but also assisted by Germany and some other countries, indicating a rift in important questions of foreign policy and security policy. But one should not overestimate the famed meeting in St. Petersburg. That meeting was really a routine, it would have been a routine meeting which takes place twice a year in the so-called Petersburg Dialogue between Russia and Germany, and it would have been considered another such meeting if Mr. Chirac had not invited himself to come to Petersburg and thus give this meeting a conspiratory character, gladly believed to be a new line of axes, as even Henry Kissinger called it in an article published a few days ago, an axis between France, Germany, and Russia. No such axis exists, and it will never come into being. The interests of the three, especially the two, France and Germany on one side and Russia on the other side, are much too divergent. And the economic disparities between France and Germany on one side and Russia on the other side certainly do not lend these three to an axis performance of any consequence or sustainability. Europe is much too closely interconnected and integrated in economic and fiscal in economic and fiscal base as to fall apart and form an old and a new Europe capable of acting independently from one another. So I think the picture was attractive. It served its purpose during the period of irritation and controversy, but it should not be used as a basis for speculation on future strategic developments. It doesn't carry that kind of weight. What will happen? First, Europe will have to get its act together. And that's one thing that Europe will have to learn from the discrepancies and differences and conflicts that arose when Chirac tried to assume foreign policy leadership for the enlarged Europe and presumed that the enlarged Europe would follow him. The first consequence of the enlargement was that he found out this new enlarged Europe would not follow him. It was quite obvious why Poland, as one of the countries that did not follow, refused to fall into line with Chirac's pronouncements as to European interests vis-à-vis American intentions in the Middle East. The new European countries, new in the term of that they are now coming into the European Union, is that these countries, Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, and others, find the presence of the United States in Europe indispensable. German and European relations in the future will be determined by discussions and developments both in the United States and in Europe. And it will be the task of the Atlantic community to coordinate these developments to determine national interests, both of the United States, by the United States, of course, and in Europe, by the countries of Europe and by Europe as a whole, and then work in bringing these interests together in a coherent form
that is capable of stabilizing the Atlantic community. From a European point of view, the United States will have to decide whether it wants, as many suggest, to become and continue to be a hegemonial power, or whether it wants to pursue a policy of multilateralism. Presently, it is very difficult for the United States to make that decision, because it is, after all, the dominating power. It has assumed most of the responsibility for the actions in the Middle East. It is looked upon by a great number of nations in the world as someone, as a nation, as a power that can perform, if you please, police functions in the world by intervening in cases where intervention seems undisputedly necessary. But I don't think that the military position of the United States alone will determine the answer to that basic question. It will also be the economic situation. As an outsider to this debate, I found it fascinating that during the last couple of months, there was a lot of talk about military might and military importance and military disparities between the United States and Europe, and rightfully so. The military budget of the United States is bigger than the budgets of the 12 ranking states after the United States put together, as the New York Times pointed out. So there is a vast disparity as far as military outlays are concerned. However, the same is not true for the economy. Even though the economy of the United States is the largest in terms of GDP, the European combined economy comes close to that. And we will have to determine in the future whether a decentralized structure of the economy, like it is developing in Europe, or a more or less homogeneous structure of an economy, as it is developing and has developed in the United States, is more efficient or more capable of solving problems of the future. If we have two strong disparities in the political, in the military area, we will be reminded, after the war is coming to an end, also in the perception of the media and the population, and the difficult and long-term work of restructuring and rebuilding, both politically and economically, Iraq, we will find, as I said before, that the economies will come to the fore and will begin to dominate our political action. And in that field, America and Europe are so closely integrated that a rift between the two of any consequences would hurt both the United States and Europe. There's an overriding national interest on part of the United States and an overriding interest on the part of Europe, not to disturb, but to further deepen this economic integration. And I'm quite sure it will continue. It has proven to be extremely valuable in the process over the last 50 years. The United States sometimes pushed Europe ahead. Europe sometimes pushed the United States ahead. Sometimes the United States were the main and prime source of economic growth. Sometimes that function shifted to Europe, and I'm sure it will continue that way. However, what we will also witness in the future is that problems of Europe and problems of the United States will be different, to say the least. The most important difference will be the difference in demographic development. The United States population will grow, and the European population will shrink. The United States population is estimated to reach between 420 and 450 million by the middle of the century, which is about 45 years from now. Which is, in terms of development, in our tendency to have a short-sighted view of developments a long time, but the shadow of that development is already visible. In Europe, the population will age and decline, and that is true for all of Europe, possibly with the exception of Great Britain, that has a very substantial immigration quota. But in Poland, in Germany, in Italy, in Spain, to take the four, and with a little time behind, in France, the population is shrinking and aging at the same time. The consequences thereof, remodeling social systems, developing a common immigration policy, checking the possible consequences of a east-west movement of people and mobility in Europe, originating in Russia and going all across the board, including East Germany, and thus a possible destabilization of the necessary composition of a population required to maintain and develop a nation's economy. This will come together with a problem that we'll all have, namely the real understanding of what the introduction of the knowledge society and the information technology means for the organization of our society, for doing business, for teaching, and for developing our culture. In the United States, the development will, as I said, be quite different as far as population growth is concerned. And the United States, during the last couple of years, in particular under the impression of the threat of terrorism, has changed its composition of society and priorities also. I remember discussions in the 70s about the military-economic complex. The discussions of the 70s on this subject are muted by the dimension of the military-economic complex and its possible political ramifications that exist today. Americans tell me that one of their greatest challenges is the educational system and the infrastructure. And, of course, we have, as I mentioned before, a public debt of dimensions that are difficult to comprehend. The budget deficit that will be accrued in the next year if the tax plan comes through on a compromise level of, say, $550 billion, the deficit will then amount, as New York Times reports, to $984 billion. $984 billion is four times the entire budget of the Federal Republic of Germany. So one can imagine the kind of long-range effects of such deficits on the world financial markets. They will have to be financed, and the United States will have to produce a lot of attraction for capital investment and for stability, for long-term stability, in order to find the kind of lenders that are necessary to finance that budget deficit. We are interested in this deficit to be financed. I don't want to be misunderstood. Europe has been carrying a very substantial load in financing the trade deficit during the last years, and for good reason. If the trade deficit isn't financed, imports suffer. And here we have a very clear cross relationship in the economic field that binds us together. Finally, European-American relations will be determined by our decisions, or by decisions in the United States, in participation with Europeans, I'm sure, as to the role of the United Nations. The first real reason for this debate, of course, is who is going to carry, or to what extent should the United Nations participate in the reconstruction of the Iraq. If I read the news correctly, Mr. Chirac has proposed has suggested that France would take a pragmatic attitude towards the solution of that problem, which I think is very good. And I'm most certain that the Germans will not see it any differently. Pragmatic, that means we're not going to get into a fight on institutions or legitimacies, but we're beginning with setting up a, let me call it, a coalition of the participating, of those who participate in the reconstruction of Iraq, and then determine a question of burden sharing. Now, burden sharing problems are not new to the Atlantic Alliance. I went through many debates on burden sharing in the 70s, 60s and 70s and early 80s between the United States and Europe. Burden sharing for a long time was a very important political issue and an issue of controversy. We will now have to determine the burden sharing in the reconstruction of Iraq. I'm quite certain that the United States, after having carried the load of the military action, will not be willing to have Europeans participate and not share in the burden. So a pragmatic approach means a solution of the burden-sharing issue. And from that burden-sharing issue will develop the next critical and important question, who is going to spend the money and who is going to be engaged industrially in this reconstruction of the Iraq, and who is going to determine the share of participation. When I remind myself of the old burden-sharing debate, the question was always involved that whether those nations who shared the burden to a certain extent, let's say 20-25%, would also receive the orders or the productivity or whatever was connected with spending that money to in favor of their national industries, defense industries at that time. This time it's not going to be primarily defense industries. It's going to be infrastructure. It's going to be building, education, and many other things. And how are we going to distribute the, very practically speaking, the purchase of these services and from what countries and in what relationship to burden sharing? These questions have to be resolved. I think it is sensible to introduce the United Nations in this process without further discussion on questions of legitimacy. Pragmatic solutions usually also help in forming institutional arrangements in given frameworks. I am not pessimistic about future European relations for one very overriding reason. We are dependent on one another, regardless of whether one is a superpower and the others are divided between old and new parties. As it will turn out in practice, Europe will be very much concerned with the enlargement process, but it will also increasingly be concerned with its responsibility for areas outside of the European Union, the most important being the Mediterranean. And the Middle East happens to be close to the Mediterranean, which is, it used to be a Roman sea, it is now a European sea. And if Europeans do not take more responsibility for that area and allow a new power vacuum, a regional power vacuum, to come into existence, then they would fail their part in the continuing American-European relations, or, let's put it in an old phrase, in the continuing Atlantic Alliance. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to comment on Dr. Biedenkopf's remarks. He is not just a distinguished observer of U.S.-European relations, as you've just seen, but a longstanding and distinguished participant in making those relations what they've been over the last 30 years. And many of us know how hard he has worked in Germany for that end. And as you've just heard, he is more eloquent than most Americans in English, including perhaps this one, which I find quite remarkable. I was thinking that when you discussed the demographic differences between the two countries and the aging of the European population, you are giving new meaning to the term Old Europe. That's true. Robert Kaplan and many others these days are saying that Americans are from Mars and Europeans are from Venus. Dr. Biedenkopf is from Saxony, which is at the very center of Western Europe, was its industrial powerhouse in the 19th century, and again under his leadership in recent years has become the leading high technology center of the East in Germany. And I think that in part inspired by that experience, perhaps the theme of Dr. Biedenkopf's remarks has been optimistic, as he said at the end, and rests on an optimism founded really on two pillars. One is a sense of common values, which is very plausible, given how common indeed the values have been across the Atlantic, and given the possibility that that may figure again in what Sam Huntington calls the clash of civilizations. Second pillar is really economic interest, and here I must say I agree that there are very substantial economic interests across the Atlantic. The value of trade across the Atlantic each year is $1.5 trillion, which is remarkable. American firms have twice as much investment in the Netherlands as they do in Mexico. There is something very serious there. And so, in a sense, although I'm sure Dr. Biedenkopf wouldn't say this, one might conclude from his remarks that if the American economy has just gone through a period of irrational exuberance, maybe American foreign policy is currently experiencing a period of irrational exuberance as well, from which we can expect harmony to ensue. Venus and Mars, Javier Solana pointed out 2 weeks ago that Venus and Mars ultimately found solace in each other's arms, and the byproduct was a daughter named Harmonia. And that's the question I want to raise, though. I think that that, in a sense, is consonant with Dr. Biedenkopf's remarks. I want to ask whether we have so many grounds for optimism. Let me begin, and I'll be relatively brief. Let me begin, though, by underscoring a couple of the points he made, with which I must say I heartily agree. We're talking here about the future of U.S.-European relations, but I think the best place to begin is with the past. And someone once said the seats in the railway cars in the train of history always face backwards. And I think it's important to remember, as he did, that this is not the first time there have been tensions in U.S.-European relations. I remember very well the tense controversies between Germany and the United States over the stationing of nuclear weapons there in the 1970s. France withdrew from the military structure of NATO, as we all well know. The French desire to lead a kind of third front composed, whether it be of the Third World or of other nations, is by no means a new aspiration, and I think we need not be so surprised by it. And indeed, there were serious trade disputes which virtually derailed the Uruguay round negotiations, if you'll remember, just a few years ago. So tension between the U.S. and Europe is not altogether new, but as Dr. Biedenkopf said, there are some new elements in it. And I, too, share the emphasis, the view that there are two key parts to those elements. Let me just underscore what I think they are. November 1989 and September 11th, 2001, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the fall of the Berlin Wall, means that no other nation can effectively challenge the military capacities of the United States. I think China will do so one day, but we're a few decades at least away from that. Now, this may not frighten our enemies, but it definitely frightens our allies. Dr. Biedenkopf was too polite to say that, but anyone who has traveled to Europe recently knows that. And indeed, I think what many Europeans wonder is whether Americans still think that they need allies. So that's the first change, 1989. The second change, which is, I think, not created by September 11th, in my view, but nonetheless certainly symbolized by it, is what we could call the ugly side of globalization. I'm a supporter of globalization and transnational social movements. Greenpeace is a transnational social movement, but Al-Qaeda is also a transnational social movement, so is Hezbollah, and I think that they're made possible on the one hand by a new openness in national borders, international transport, and the second element here is the potential available in weapons of mass destruction, and of nuclear weapons in particular, whose capacities I think are more serious than those of chemical or biological weapons. These threats are often exaggerated, but they can't be entirely discounted. And this is where I have to ask whether the optimism that Dr. Biedenkopf has expressed, and which I would like to share, is fully justified. I think there's some possibility that the structural challenges facing the U.S.-European relationship are deeper, more resolutely strategic and military than one might hope. Let me explain why I say that. The significance of these two developments, 1989 and September 11th, is that deterrence, long the backbone of nuclear security, may no longer guarantee national security. Now, I happen to believe that deterrence will work when its aim, its target, in a sense, is another nation state. There are those who would debate that, but I think that is correct. But I think it's indisputable that it does not work well against transnational terrorist movements. So the source of the most profound potential conflict between Europe and the U.S., in my view, is really this question of how to respond to this new threat to national security. And so we could ask, what are the available responses? And can Europe and the U.S. ever agree on one? That seems to me the hardest question here. And let me say one thing about it. At the moment, the issue is usually presented as a choice between unilateralism as a general approach, a one nation, the United States in particular, acting alone, or multilateralism, essentially working through the framework of international organizations and with allies. Unilateralism appears in this country, of course, in its strongest form in some interpretations given to the preemptive strike strategy of the Bush administration. And multilateralism, not surprisingly, is, of course, the preferred position of the Europeans, since they have a strong voice in the international organizations that would operate it. But here's the problem. Problem is that there are serious flaws to either of these options as a solution to the problem of national security at the moment. Multilateral negotiations are slow. And as we learned in the case of Kosovo, often agreement cannot be reached while the threat is still a live one. Unilateral action is faster. But leaving even aside the sensibilities of the Europeans, the problem is that it cannot do the full job. I mean, it's possible to intervene militarily in Iraq, but as the Bush administration has learned, perhaps to its surprise, nation building is something else again. Intervention provides no durable solutions without something like nation building that follows, and nation building ultimately requires a multilateral effort. If we think about the structure that was built around U.S.-European relations over the last several decades, and to build those relations over the last 50 years, we include NATO, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs and Trade. We would include the Bretton Woods monetary regime with the International Monetary Fund. We would include the World Bank. What do we see? We see a structure of international relations which is somewhere between multilateral and unilateral. Multilateral, surely, in the sense that there are organizations in which multiple countries have a strong voice, but nonetheless organizations in which the United States has really, for the last five decades, been the first among equals, primus inter pares, in a sense, and recognized as such in most cases by most members of those organizations. So in a sense, this alternative, this rejection of, let's say, unilateralism, multilateralism, offers a kind of hope, a basis for the sort of optimism that Dr. Biedenkopf has expressed. But I think, finally, we have to ask, can we get there? I mean, there's good news and bad news here in the sense that the good news is, and here I agree completely with what Dr. Biedenkopf has said, as far as I can see, there are no strategic conflicts of interest between Europe and the United States with regard to these issues. And that's of great importance. The bad news is that it's not so easy to construct these kinds of relationships in which there's a balance of American power on the one hand and a multilateral agreement on the other. So the final question I ask then is, what would be required to operate this kind of multilateralism? What is going to be required if U.S.-European relations are going to improve? Let me ask first, what's required on the European side? And to provoke you, I suggest at least two potential requirements. First, I think somewhat higher defense spending. I think the notion that there should be a clear division of labor in which the America wields the military power and Europe does peacekeeping and nation building is ultimately not viable. America cooks, Europe does the dishes. I think that is not always the basis for a good marriage. When I think of the U.S.-European relationship, by the way, I must say, well, we know that for years it's been a love-hate relationship, and it's important to remember that at the current time. And when I think of that, I think of this old story about a couple who'd been married for 30 years, gone through many fights, and a friend asked, in the midst of one of these fights, 30 years of this, you know, haven't you considered divorce? And the response was, murder, yes, divorce, never. And I think that is true of the U.S.-European relationship. Well, what would be required on the European side? I think, and will we get it? I think somewhat higher levels of defense spending, and this is something of which Dr. Biedenkopf has great experience, some reorganization of defense forces, because the problem is not simply spending. The problem is the character of the European militaries. I won't take the time to explain just why. Can we be optimistic about this? I would say yes. I mean, not immediately, because the European economy needs to recover if more money is to be spent on defense, but the Sam Mellow Initiative suggests I think we can be optimistic about that. I'd say, though, there's one other requirement, and that is more effective coordination in Europe, a real common foreign and security policy. This is Henry Kissinger's complaint in 1974. Henry Kissinger declared 1974 the year of Europe, as you'll remember, but he also said that year that the problem, I'm paraphrasing here, but the problem with Europe is that there's no phone number, there's no one person to call. Well, there's still no one person to call. Will that ever be the case? I think the European Convention is revising European institutions, as we know, and I think that will produce some small steps forward, probably at least a common foreign minister-type position for the Union. But foreign policy is still a prerogative of national governments, jealously guarded, and so I'm not so sanguine about whether this requirement will be fulfilled. The dilemma here is that Europe is in the process of redefining itself. And it's therefore very difficult for it to develop a clear and effective position in the international world. I would say the same is true of Germany. In the international sphere, with regard to foreign policy, I would say Germany is redefining itself at the moment. I think it's inconceivable that 20 years ago, that in the midst of an election, nonetheless a hard-fought election, a German chancellor, having failed to campaign effectively against Mr. Stoiber, would campaign against Mr. Bush. I actually think it's a healthy sign. I think it's good that is now possible, that the American reaction, we know something about electoral politics in this country, I think the American reaction was overstated. But I think this is a sign of change in German foreign policy. I welcome those changes. I think there's a new assertiveness that can be a very constructive assertiveness. Finally, what would be required on the American side to improve relations? Again, two things, I think. First of all, a recognition of the value of what Joe Nye calls soft power, namely realization that the war against terrorism is also a struggle for hearts and minds, realization that it'll really be won at the level of intelligence agencies, and that requires the kind of cooperation that can be secured only by the sorts of good relations that are strained at the moment. In other words, hard power, military power, can accomplish only so much. And that, I think, is an important thing to say. Now, this is not to say that there shouldn't be some saber rattling. When you have a good saber, it's useful to rattle it. I'm not worried about the statements Donald Rumsfeld, who is the linguistic hitman for the administration, has made about Syria. I think that was right. I mean, if you have a chance to persuade Syria to be a little better on these issues, why not speak with a loud voice? But speaking with a loud voice is one thing, and going farther is another. And that takes me to my last point. I think it's a kind of subtle point, but it speaks to this issue of values. In a sense, Dr. Biedenkopf calls for a better understanding, although he put that in a much more sophisticated way. And I certainly agree we need some understanding here. I'm surprised by what I see as the decline in what we might call diplomacy. You know, diplomacy has a meaning as a term, and it includes a notion of civility. It suggests that even when two states disagree very sharply on important conflicts of interest, they can discuss that with an artificial level of politeness that is no less useful for being artificial, knowing that they will have to discuss something else again. And I think that on both sides of the Atlantic, there's a way in which more intense partisan conflict, certainly apparent in this country, in domestic politics, has spilled over a little bit into international relations. The intemperate language that has become, and has always been the hallmark of intense party conflict inside a country, has become a little bit the language of foreign policy, and that is a problem. So I conclude only by saying that, we want Venus and Mars to produce harmonia, and as all musicians know, harmony depends on overtones, as well as the basic score. I think the basic score, as Dr. Biedenkopf suggests, is in good shape. I wish the overtones were a little more mellifluous than they seem today. Thank you.
Krupp Foundation Professor of European Studies at Harvard University, Peter Hall. Earlier, we heard from Professor Dr. Kurt Biedenkopf, former Minister President of Saxony. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15 and includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog with help from John Perotti and John Hoder. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.
Tomorrow on The Connection. Tomorrow on The Connection.